Pinch hitting for James Murphy. We have Kevin Walsh.
What's up, Walsh?
I want to get this straight. Am I the second option or the third option here?
You know what? I think you're the first option when Murph is not available, if you want to look at it that way. But I will say this. There's always plans to have you, to have Mike Giardi, to have Murph, to have the entire Comcast Sportsnet family, hockey family involved in this show. Do you believe that?
I don't believe you at all.
All right, we're going to talk.
Based on what you just said and like how you tried to sell me that bill, because I thought I was the second option. Now I'm thinking I'm the third.
Absolutely not. But we're going to talk about it more. Let's get the show started. And welcome back to Great American Hockey Show podcast. Joe Haggerty, Kevin Walsh. First order of business, Walshy. We've got Mike Motto a little later in the show. But let's talk a little Eastern Conference. Let's talk a little NHL. We're a month into the season. Thanksgiving's only a couple weeks away. Who's for real in this Eastern Conference? Who's fraudulent? Who's emerging for you?
First of all, who's for real is the Washington Capitals. I mean, we can just go on down the line. Holtby is so good. The Bruins can't score on him. That's obvious. Alexander Ovechkin, he just has – under Barry Trotz, I just think he just has a new sense of purpose and maturity. And he's starting – I wouldn't say he's a full two-way player, but he's certainly a lot better than he has been in the past.
Well, he's not in coach killer mode, so that's good.
No, I mean I think
he can certainly destroy things if he wants to.
He's done it in the past. Yeah. But I think he's just reached the point that he's – How old is he now? Is he 30 yet?
Yeah, he's around 30.
Okay, so he's been in the league a long time. He hasn't won a Stanley Cup. He has the ability that
– He's got some gray in his beard these days.
He probably – and that's because he's been living pretty hard and playing pretty hard.
Yeah.
In a lot of – but he doesn't have a ring. And I just think he senses that there's some father time is ticking. He's got to get it done right. And so what a lot of people do when it's not going the way they want to in their careers, not just in sports, is they sort of reinvent themselves. And sometimes they stay where they are or they get better. And I think he's just become a much more well-rounded player. And he has the respect of his teammates now that I'm not saying he didn't have before, but he has more of it. And that's the difference there. The fraudulent teams, I'm worried about the Bruins. This good some nights and bad other nights. What we saw against Colorado at home, that was disgraceful.
Well, it's not only that, Walshy. It's you play Dallas, you play Washington. It was men against boys when they played the Capitals. They were far superior. They self-destruct in Montreal after getting destroyed there on home ice at the beginning of the year. And really what you see with the Bruins is what you get, which is they're not a playoff team, really. They're certainly not in the caliber of the best teams in the East.
Not a chance.
And when they show signs like the game against Colorado that you're talking about, not just that game, other games, especially when they play on home ice, they show this allowance of other teams to outwork them when they're not close to the most talented team in the league and they have to work for everything that they get. When that's not there and they're getting outworked and the work ethic is gone, like, what do you have there? You know, it's a bunch of guys just sort of shifting around aimlessly on the ice and playing good for 10 minutes at the start of the game and then blowing leads in the second and third period. You know, there's no excuse for that.
Right.
They're not good
enough
to do that.
Right. It's the definition of a bad team. Yep. Anybody can play good for 10 minutes if they can't sustain it for the long haul. Against a team like Colorado who didn't have who played two nights before. The Bruins had 4 days, so they should have been well-rested and everything, and it just didn't work out. But then when you have games like what they had against the Islanders, in which they got out a win, maybe don't play their best hockey, but Tuukka plays good, and they just kind of gut it out against a good team, I think that's the frustration for the fans and those that watch hockey pretty closely. It's like, who is this team? But I guess you're right.
And the frustration.
They're a 500 team at best, and they may even – and that may be the top end of it. It may get worse before it gets better.
Yeah, I think definitely if they don't clean up their act on home ice. But what you're looking at right now is a team that may hover around the eighth spot. You know, they're going to probably be a few points out of a playoff spot come Thanksgiving time. And it's a team that's playing mediocre hockey. They are what they are. They're very good offensively. They're great on the power play, and they suck defensively. They're terrible. You know, and there's not a lot of – maybe Seidenberg, once he gets really full up and going, will make a little bit of a difference. But I don't see the kind of answers on this team that are going to turn them into a playoff threat. You know, you look at Montreal, that's an elite team in the East right now. You look at the Rangers, that's a very good team. They've had some losses from last year, but they're still playing top-notch hockey. Washington, as you mentioned, an outstanding team. Tampa Bay is underachieving right now.
Yeah, that's
but
that's
you know
the
that they're going to come back.
Right, because you can see the skill that team has in the fire. firepower. They're going through like a weird stretch right now. But so they're underachieving right now, but I wouldn't count them out.
No, I wouldn't either. No, I wouldn't at all. I think something's wrong with that team right now. I think Steven Stamkos maybe and he and John Cooper aren't on the same page where there's not performance from some of their top players. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there's something weird going on where they're much greater or much less than the sum of their parts right now where there's a dysfunction. And that's part of what we're seeing in the underachievement. So I just wonder, with his contract talks and everything else, how this is all involved and how badly or inconsistently they've played to start the year. But it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. I think the Bruins are definitely in that middle class, lower middle class, with the Wings, the Senators, the Penguins, the Devils, Islanders, teams like that. But I just think they're a notch below a lot of those teams, and barring major improvements, which aren't going to be coming, they're going to stay there. But coming up next, now that we're done with this, why don't we talk to Mike Motta and see what he thinks just about his career in hockey in general. What do you think, Walt?
Yeah, let's do it.
Show podcast, and joining us is former Boston Bruin, former Boston College Eagle, played over 300 games in the NHL, Mike Motta. Mike, how are you? You're here with Joe Haggerty and Kevin Walsh.
Doing great. Thanks for having me on today.
What made you decide you wanted to be a defenseman? What pushed you in that direction? Most kids want to be, you know, forwards where they're getting all the goal scoring glory and stuff like that. Like, what made you gravitate towards playing D?
My brother was a defenseman, but also, you know, watching Ray Bourque as I was growing up, and Brian Leetch. You know, I played a little bit of forward in D, you know, depending on what, you know, the coaches wanted. But ultimately, I felt more comfortable having the play in front of me and passing the puck, and not so much, you know, really relying on, like the goal scoring to dictate how well I played. It was just more the pucks and being part of a good team, yeah.
Mike, how old were you when you thought, hey, I might have a shot? I might have a shot at playing in the NHL and having hockey be a living and a huge part of your life?
That's a good question. It's interesting because I actually answered this question to someone the other day, last week, and I always tried to stay in the present, which was trying to be the best I could be at that practice or at that game. But if I had to really think back, I'd say as college was moving along, it was probably like junior year that I had a couple good games, and people were mentioning people signing and whatnot. So up until that point though, it was just more stay in the present and get as good as I could be, physically and skill set, and see where it would take me. But I'd say later on in my college career would be the time frame where I started kind of realizing that I had a chance to play after college.
During those years at Thayer and BC, what was the best, the most resonant message that you felt you got from a coach there, or advice, or something that stuck with you when you were done playing, high school and college hockey and went on to the pro ranks? Is there anything that sticks out in your mind as an experience or a conversation or, something that one of your coaches said to you that really stuck with you?
Just playing to your strengths. My high school coach was really adamant about developing, every part of your game. He had D playing forward, forwards playing D, and just really understanding, the different positions. It made me a better defenseman, knowing what was difficult for a forward to deal with, like rimming the puck around the boards mindlessly and just like kind of passing my troubles on to someone else was something that I kind of learned by the coach mentioning, I want you to know what a forward has to deal with. And, ultimately one of my strengths was my hockey intellect and, beating a forecheck, knowing where your guys are, where the opposing team wants, what they want to do, what they're trying to accomplish, and then kind of use your head and your skill to kind of combat that. So I'd say just knowing, different positions and then playing to your strengths were the two things that I could take from, from some conversations that I had over those years.
How special did it feel playing for Jerry York at BC? I mean, was there an aura around him kind of when you played for him that this is, you know, going to go down as one of the best college hockey coaches of all time? How do you explain him or describe him to people when you say this is what it was like to play for him at BC?
Well, at the time he came in and BC was down a bit. It was 94. I came in 96, so we're still in the rebuilding stages. Beyond the hockey, though, is, you know, he's a great person, and he develops good people, good character people, and I think that, you know, transcends, you know, well beyond the game. And for me to, you know, play under him for 4 years and learn, you know, the right things to do, not even at the rink, but you know, away and a certain way to carry yourself. Those are the things that I look back and I speak highly about him in those regards. And, you know, that's something like I was at BC the you know, last couple weeks ago, and, you know, everyone you run into and everyone you see across hockey it's the same thing. So I just reinforce what everyone already sees, and he's a real special person, and he does have, you know, a glow around him, but, you know, it's not because of the wins and losses, it's just because of the person he is.
Mike, we see with the top, we see how the game, the feeder program into the NHL has changed, whereas now college hockey is one of the great feeding programs into the NHL, whereas before it was either through Europe or through junior hockey in Canada. But you stayed all 4 years, and then you won the Hobey Baker Award. Why was it important to you to stay all 4 years? Were you looking at life that were you trying to protect yourself and get your education in case it didn't work out, or you just didn't see an opportunity for you to make that jump early, like a lot of players of today, like Johnny Gaudreau, for example, have done?
I had an opportunity after my sophomore and junior year to leave, and for me, getting an education, getting that, you know, degree was very important, as well as having conversations with Coach York. Going back to him, he pretty much said, he's like, you can't put a price tag on what you're going to experience, you know, your senior year. And he was absolutely right. And I encourage kids to go to college, you know, like as I, you know, I'm talking to parents and stuff, and just for the reason of, and it's such a developmental time in your life, you know, to grow away from the rink, as well as being able to physically mature with weight room work and the discipline to go to class. And stuff that, you know, at the rink you can get similar stuff, at, you know, through juniors and whatnot. But for me, to, you know, I'm biased to it, but I think that if you're good enough, you're going to be able to play. And I would say give yourself an opportunity to meet people and have a network of people for when you're done playing. That's the biggest thing that I can say about college hockey and college in general, is the people that you meet, and I was able to meet a lot of great people through BC.
So what kind of a student were you? I have a little knowledge on you, because I know somebody that had a class with you. I'll tell you who he is in a minute, but what would you say your experience was like as a student at BC?
We've got some intel on Mike Motto.
Mike, it's nothing to be nervous about, so I'll just let you know. So speak freely.
No, to be honest with you, it's a big change to go from, you know, being in high school and being very structured, and you have to be there, and you know, and that's just the way it is in high school. But when you have a lot of free time, and plus with the demands of the five classes, and then the demands of physically of going to the rank, and, you know, it was an adjustment. It was a change. As for a student, I would say I would, you know, the pinnacle of mediocrity, you know, but being, you know, when you're there and had the time to, you know, to dig in, you know, I was fine. I would just say an average student, but at the end of it, it's really about time management and being disciplined to go to class.
Did you have a public speaking class with a professor that had somewhat of an accent?
Yes.
Okay, this is where I'm getting at, because you had class with my younger brother who shared a name with you. His name was Michael as well. Yeah. And he said there were a number of athletes in there. He said you're very honest about your work. You did the work. You didn't big time anybody or anything. And he said you were a pretty good public speaker who often the students would, you would team up with somebody and you would introduce the other person, and you're teamed up with a young lady who said, this is Mike Motto. His dream is to become a professional hockey player. He's on his way. He's been drafted by the New York Islanders, and that's the story that my brother shared. He shared some others that maybe you guys ended up at the same party.
Did they involve Marianne's or something like that?
No, I'm not going down that road in any way. Yeah. But they're very positive because he's going to be listening later on. But he enjoyed the time with you, and he says hello, Mike, so that's why I shared.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, be sure to say hello. And to be honest with you, that was one of my favorite classes at BC. It allowed you to get up in front people and feel uncomfortable and, you know, kind of fight through those kind of fears of being, you know, public speaking. And, you know, if you're going to be doing anything, you know, presentation wise or you know, if you in front of people, and it's such a skill to have, and not really kind of get locked up when you're not too sure.
So did that ultimately help you in your professional career when you had to meet with the media and annoying people like Joe Haggerty who are asking you questions?
Well, it did, actually, you know, because of those, you know, the reasons why I said you get up and you have to be prepared enough, but you can also be, you know, think on the fly and be able to process some information while you're in front of people. I think it's definitely a life skill that I wasn't really, you know, projecting that far ahead, but it was a great class looking back, and one of my favorites.
Yeah, for the record, multiple sources have told me that Kevin Walsh is a much more annoying presence in the Bruins dressing room.
I've annoyed a few people,
Joe Haggerty.
I'm as guilty as you, Joe.
But we can move on from Boston College. And what was your mindset like? Drafted by the Rangers, you got some NHL games the following season after you left BC. You're coming off being a Hobey Baker winner, and you know, I got to imagine at that point you feel like the NHL is right there for your grasp, and you're going to be in the league as a regular within a couple of years, and that, you know, doesn't end up happening, and you pay your dues in the A for quite some time, 5, 6, 7 years before you really become a regular in the NHL. What was that whole experience like for you, truly paying your dues in the American Hockey League before getting to the NHL?
Well, coming out of BC and then getting into the Rangers organization, I felt I played well enough to make the squad out of training camp. But, you know, for me, again, I have the ability to look back on it, but I feel that there was some unfair expectations of my game, you know, comparing me to Brian Leetch, which is, you know, he's a Hall of Famer, you know, he's just a special player. And instead of going that way, I would have much rather them, you know, let me come in at my own speed and, you know, kind of value me for who I am versus putting some lofty expectations on my game. But that being said, you know, went through 3 years with them, up and down, and didn't fully make it to the NHL till, you know, the New Jersey Devils valued some of my skill set, you know, hockey intellect, like we were going to go back to. And for me to put my time in the minors, it made making it to the NHL full-time that much more rewarding. It, you know, you appreciate it a little bit more. You know, you don't want to let it go, so you do whatever it takes to stay. And, you know, I scored a goal relatively soon into the season. It was like 3 or 4 games in, and after that, I was like, no one can take that away from me. So that was just a great thrill, kind of a sense of accomplishment. But then you still stay hungry to be there, and, you know, you're not motivated solely by the check, but it was a big difference, you know. So I'm starting to have kids, and you value the number that you're getting every other week, and you know, that along with just being in the best league in the country, I mean in the world, and adding value. So overall, the time put in was well worth it, and you know, the sacrifices that the family had to make through going to different minor league cities and the travel and all that, it was well worth it.
Was there a favorite story from the American League days, just whether it was a gong show on the ice, a guy that you played with, like something that, you know, sticks out in your mind, is it puts a smile on your face when you think about it now of the time you spent in that league?
Yeah, there was a bunch. You know, there's a little bit more, there's a few more characters down in those in the minor league. So a lot of the bus rides were great, but there was one game that we played Wilkes-Barre in Hartford, and they had a really tough team, and one of my best friends, Brendan Buckley, was playing on that team, and we were out there, and it was a big line brawl, and we paid off, and I'm just like, hey, you know, make it look good, let's throw out the shoulder pads, you know, instead of, like, throwing, we were not hitting each other, really, but we just made it look really good, so we got thrown out of the game. So it was, at the end of it, it's just one of those things where, you know, you get a chance to play against one of your best friends, and then a few years later, we're roommates in the minors as well, so having him, you know, being able to play with, in that story alone is priceless. He just got married a couple weeks ago, and we're kind of reminiscing about it, so it's a good story.
Mike, was there ever a time that you fell out of love with hockey where it just wasn't working out, where maybe you were in the minors and you really thought you deserved to be back up? Because you've gone back and forth a lot, or did you just always love it?
It definitely tested your, it was more of a mindset. It tested it, and that's why when I made it full time, it was more rewarding because I didn't resign myself to being a minor leaguer. I worked out every summer that I was going to be in the NHL in that preparation, and then when the opportunity came, I was prepared for it. So it was like opportunity, kind of met preparation, and for me, that's more valuable because, you know, it's tough when you're not getting a look and you're still continuing to do the right thing. You're being a pro, you're getting out on the ice early, you're staying late, you're doing your stuff off ice. So to get rewarded for that, but like there were some dark times, not so much the minor. That was just more, you know, kind of just perseverance, getting through it. But I got hurt a couple times when I was in the NHL, and you know, some really some difficult times with that because it was opportunity to like continue your career and add value. But at the end of it, you come out of it. You have some perspective and realize where you are and kind of move on to try to stay positive as much as you can.
That first real opportunity, the major opportunity there with the New Jersey Devils, and you really established yourself as an NHL player there. How much do you respect just Lou Lamoriello when he was there? It seemed like he really not only liked cerebral players and players with high hockey IQ, but also had a real value for college hockey players that are, you know, sort of in vogue now, and a lot of teams are going after them, especially the undrafted ones they can sign as free agents. But it seemed like he was ahead of the curve as far as, you know, looking at the Hockey East guys, looking at the ECAC, CHL guys as real viable players that he could use in his organization.
Yeah, that's, you know, comes from his background. He was at Providence College for a number of years, and the way he runs the organization is great because, you know, there's no gray areas. It's black and white. You know what, where you stand, and there's some structure there. And, you know, once you're within that framework, you know, if you can find your spot and your niche, you can be a really valuable player on that team and in that organization. And it's just, it was refreshing, let me just say, to be valued for stuff that, you know, wasn't really, you know, in vogue. Like you said, at the time, it was, you know, I'm not the biggest, strongest, fastest guy, but I could get us out of our end, you know, say a skilled play, meaning like a decision, like a backhand pass up the middle, who, you know, that's what's open. And so you consistently do that and duplicate what you're good at, and that's where he found the value in me. But getting to your point, that he definitely leaned on the college guys because of the things we already talked about, like the discipline, the work ethic, and as far as I can see, the results have been there for the Devils, and hopefully he has some success in Toronto now.
Some of the eccentricities, true, that you hear about him in
like
the organization
off the
he runs.
Everywhere.
Well, turning off the lights everywhere, and the one I heard was the phone had to be picked up on the first ring, like when they were picking up the telephones. Within the office and stuff like that. Like, were there a lot of different things like that? Like, he ran a tight ship his way, and it was kind of like, oh, that's interesting. I've never seen that before.
Yeah, I mean, there is a few things. Like, we got treated, extremely well as players. You know, I can't speak to the staff as much, but we, as players, we were not denied anything. We were actually given luxury because what he thought was, let me take care of everything I can take care of. So then the players, all they have to do is focus on what they need to do to make this team better. And you know, that's a nice way to look at it. But if you're not doing the right things, then he has no time for you. And I think there's it goes to accountability. And when I told him after I was done playing with him, that, you know, the skills that, you know, I was able to obtain, you know, within the Devils organization will help me throughout the rest of my life. You know, it was just not only hockey, it just outside of the rink, you know, and it's really nice to have a friend like him in hockey too, because I can pick up the call on my phone and give him a call, and, you know, he'll answer, we can have a good conversation.
Mike, it's a dangerous game. We see it all the time. We saw it last night. There was an unfortunate hit between the Bruins and the Avalanche with Gabriel Landeskog and Brad Marchand. Fortunately, Marchand is okay, but it was a blindside hit. But one incident always makes me think of others. I mean, I think of Joe. I think of Matt Cook and Mark Savard and just any number of things.
Which that hit last night was a little reminiscent of, actually, the way it came
down. The way he went helicoptering afterward. In your case, it was a puck to the eye by Zach Bogosian. I saw the video of it. It's hard to see. What are your memories of that, and how are you doing in life? How much has that incident affected you professionally, personally, psychologically?
Well, that was you know, you've been hit in the face a bunch, you know, sticks, you know, fists, pucks, whatever, but this was a different type of pain that I felt. It was, I didn't see it coming, and luckily the puck hit me vertically, so my eyebrow and my cheekbone protected my eyeball a bit, and so when I got hit, I went down, pulled my gloves off, and all I could see is blood, and I couldn't see out of my eye, so I felt my eyeball had been squished, and so I went into the dressing room, and that was a very difficult time for me. I wasn't able to see for about a week, but they said everything was intact, and if the blood in the eye went down, I'd be able to see partially. So luckily, all that remains is that my pupils constantly dilated. So, like on sunny days, you know, I have to wear sunglasses a little bit more. The reflection off snow is a little bit, you know, more bothersome. But it was a tough time because I wasn't diagnosed with a concussion, but for sure I got dinged up there. And with the rehab, I guess you want to call it, like, you know, someone prodding your eyeball 3 times a week. It was, looking back, it wasn't great, but I'm just happy to still have some sight in it and be able to, watch my kids graduate pretty much. That's what I was making some deals with the big guy when I was in the ambulance on the way to the hospital.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you're okay. And when something like that happens, be it in your case, or the thing that I always find interesting about hockey is the story behind the story, like, and just what happened, Jill, last night, mm-hmm. and Mike with Marchand and Landeskog is, and I talked to Landeskog after the game, and he said he knew it was a bad play, and it was his bad, and he was going over to say he was sorry, and then Marchand punched him. I'm not saying Marchand shouldn't have done it, but there's often more than one victim. I mean, you're the biggest victim in here, but when somebody is the driver behind something, it sometimes impacts them as well. Did Bogosian ever reach out to you and just see how you're doing? Because I think hockey players, they care about each other because they know it could always be them.
I remember when Ryan Callahan broke his leg blocking his Dano Chara shot, and Chara, for days afterwards, was, you know, asking about him, really concerned about it,
right.
and seemed shaken up. And obviously, you know, when you've got a 108-mile-an-hour slap shot, you're going to use it pretty responsibly on the ice and know how badly you could hurt somebody. But that is an interesting point. Did you ever end up, like, chatting with Bogosian?
No, I never got a chance to talk with him. I was in Atlanta for, you know, a few days, and I think they had traveled elsewhere. But no, I never got a chance. But it was, you know, kind of a fluky play. It was a rolling puck, you know, off a stick possibly. Even so, it's really no blame on him. It's just, you know, just an unfortunate situation. If I had to look back on it, it was kind of a turnover, bad change type thing, like a bad gap, and then I'm just standing in front. So there's really no blame to be placed, but overall, it definitely impacted my, say, you know, perception of, you know, visors and safety. There's no reason why I didn't have a visor on, so you can always look back on that and kind of kick yourself. But, I mean, other than that, there's really no lasting impressions that I have, other than not being able to see that great.
What was it like for you in your career? It was an interesting timeline where that's really where concussions started becoming a major thing. People were paying more attention to it. Teams were paying more attention to it. And, you know, just sort of seeing how they were treated at the beginning of your career, where guys were getting their bell rung or dinged or whatever. And then as your career went on, seeing how much more important, how much more care was put into the recognition of them, the treatment of them, and, you know, sitting guys out when they were banged up like that.
Yeah, that's been a real advancement in the training, athletic training area. There's guys that I've seen, and, you know, unfortunately, the news of guys, not doing great after, with the concussions. A lot of them are fighters, or someone who had a pretty bad injury, or, like Pronger, for example. But to have it, the ones that really, kind of last are the ones that are, right in between, getting cleared, and not like the little ones that kind of can creep up on you in an extended period of fogginess, as they say. And I've only had one, and it just definitely changes your mood, and like everything about your kind of your day to day is affected. So I think the attention to at least a diagnosis and then treatment is huge. It was back in the day, it was you got Dan, you seen stars, get back out there. Now it's, you don't take those words too lightly, and I think that's really important, because the lasting effects after hockey could, be long term, and that's just affect its quality of life after hockey. And that's one of the areas that I know all sports, including youth sports, are really, it's a hot button issue, and for the right reasons. So,
Mike, we started with how you got started in the game, where you're from, and everything. Where are you now? What are you doing in the game for those that don't know? How's the home life with four little kids? Are you still skating from time to time?
He was actually supposed to skate right now, and he took time out of his skating to sit on with us.
Oh,
so he definitely
right?
still skates.
Okay.
Yeah, today is the first day of has-been hockey. it's good. There's a local group of guys. Guy Dennis Murphy runs it, and I skated a few times in the morning before work, and it's just it's well organized, and it's just just go out, push pucks around, and get a good sweat in. So today was the first day, but there's going to be another one, so no worries on missing that one. But at the end, I'm working with Morgan Stanley right now, doing some private wealth management, and I'm also scouting with the Chicago Blackhawks part time. In the Northeast here with the colleges, it keeps me in the game. And, fortunately, part of a great organization, and they ended up getting me a Stanley Cup ring from last year's victory. So a little embarrassed about it that I couldn't win one playing. Couldn't win one, but I'll take it. My kids love it. And it's an amazing, amazing piece of jewelry that represents a great organization.
Yeah, at the end, I'd be remiss if we didn't at least mention you playing with the Bruins there at the tail end of your career. What was it like, hometown kid, wearing the black and gold, and sort of living out that fantasy before your career was over, and being around, some of the guys up close that won the Cup too, and sort of seeing the inner workings of that team, the nucleus of that team that was still left when you got there?
It was great. I was driving to the Wounded Warriors, Walter Reed Clinic in Washington, D.C., when I got the call. And the coach was, Kathy was like, "Oh, well, Monty, you got traded." I'm like, "Oh, huh?" And he's like, "Yeah, you got traded to," it was a click, "you got cut off." I was like, "Oh, what's going on here?" So he called me back, and he's like, "You got traded to the Bruins." And I was like, I was with a couple other players, and I couldn't really celebrate because, but like they knew enough where it was a dream come true to come back and play, for the Bruins and put that sweater on, going back to like growing up, shooting tennis balls against the garage door, pretending you're Cam Neely, Ray Bourque, as far as, a kid, a local kid, and then being able to realize that dream was pretty special. So the group, it was like a comfortable situation for me too, because the group the core of the guys that had won the Cup and were on the team, I had known for a number of years. They'd come back from their respective homes prior to training camp, and I would be running, just like an informal, pre-training camp skate, and they would all come down and, I'd run some drills. So I got to know a lot of the guys. So when I walked into the locker room, it was really seamless and, very welcoming. And I'm still friends with a few of those guys today. And, they had a great run there. And now it's just a little bit of a turnover and some change, but still some optimism here with some of these young guys.
Absolutely. And, because I like Inside the Actors Studio so much and James Lipton, I'm going to rip off a little bit of his thing to end the interview here with a couple questions, just quick, random questions about your hockey career and life. And what's the proudest moment in your career when you look back on it now?
Proudest moment, winning the Hobey Baker was somewhat humbling because of the team, aspect of, what we all strive to do. But looking back, they have excellence in character as the motto on it, and it's something to be proud of and be able to kind of show kids and try to, let them know that it's not just an individual award, it's a way you live your life.
Favorite stick you played with in your career?
I might have to go back to Bauer-Linden curve. It was a two-piece. I used it in college, and then I just made that into a one-piece. So the Linden curve.
Yeah, you tweaked it a little bit?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Your favorite sports movie of all time?
I'd have to say Slapshot.
Of course. Is there a character that you kind of always envisioned yourself as in the movie?
That's a great question. There's a couple guys, depending on what mood I'm in. It could be a guy like Mo.
And was it ever Reg?
That's an easy one, though. Like, I want to go off the beaten path.
There you go. I like that.
How many times have you seen it, Mike?
I was allowed to see it at an earlier age, even though with all the the swearing and everything. But I'd say it's gonna be well over 40 times.
Okay, and if you're just flipping through the channels and you see it, do you stop and just watch it?
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
I figure.
Yeah. Always have to do that. All right, we're gonna end it with you being Mo from Slapshot. Mikey, thank you very much for the time. I appreciate it, and we'll see you at the rink soon.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot, guys.
All right, Walshy, always good to catch up with Mike Motto. And, one thing we didn't get to broach with him, but we'll talk about now, and it was a lot of chatter about it this week, is the fact that goal scoring is down in the league again this year. That the coaches, the players, the executives, everybody is trying to come up with ways to promote goal scoring, from enlarging the nets to decreasing the size of the crease to, not allowing players to leave their feet to block shots, to all this kind of crazy stuff. Do you see it as a huge problem? And what's your, favorite pet solution to this?
I'm a big fan of more scoring. I have said for a long time, I probably didn't say it publicly, and increase the size of the net. Why not? I mean, do you remember back when the Islanders were flying high when they won the four straight?
Yeah, Mike Bossy.
Stanley, right?
Awesome.
You could see him coming down the right wing, and you could see there was a net to shoot at. Now, when you have that kind of player's perspective over the shoulder shot, there's no net to shoot at. That's why all the goals that we see, they're greasy goals or they're a redirect shot. There's no net to shoot at because of the angles that the goalies are playing and because of the size of the pads and the size of the goaltenders themselves. I say increase the goal size by 30%. I don't think that the goal scoring will increase commensurate with that. It may increase 20%, and that's enough for me. I just want to see more beautiful goals where you have a nice snapshot inside the blue line or a nice wrist shot or just a clean slap shot winner. What's wrong with that? I do understand Claude Julien's point to say, well, why should we punish the goaltenders for playing well? And you know what? I didn't think of that. Okay, you have a good point, but I still feel that goal scoring would certainly help the game. And clearly the NHL wanted to see more speed and more sex appeal to the game when they eliminated the two-line pass. So why not? And also the icing for safety thing, go ahead and do it. It's just people will adjust, and then we just have a new normal.
Well, everything they did, Walsh, coming out of that lockout where they lost the whole season, was to promote scoring, to bump it up. They got rid of the clutching and grabbing and, you know, a lot of the interference that would happen in the
fantastic.
Game.
Fantastic.
It was. And, you know, I think now they need to make another adjustment, because clearly coaches like Claude Julien, who are masters of the neutral zone and the defensive zone, have tramped down on that offense and are now – you know, clamping down and finding loopholes and ways to reduce goal scoring. I think making the net taller while not widening it out is a possible option, I guess.
That's
especially
fine.
Where goalies now are taller than they ever were. You know, you've got Ben Bishop is like 6'7". Gustafsson on the Bruins is 6'3". All the goalies. It seems like the Bruins just drafted a 6'5" kid this summer from Slovakia. It seems like every team has this mammoth kid in their system or playing in the NHL that's 6'4", 6'5", 6'6". And as Claude said, it's not like the old days with Gump Worsley where the guy was like 5'9", 5'10". You don't see those goalies really anymore. So I guess there's an argument to be made for that, but I think before they get anywhere close to that, scale down on the Michelin men that are between the net. These guys are big enough physically as it is now.
How much
you've got to be able to reduce the pads even more than the 2 inches they've already taken off the leg pads.
Is that all it was?
Yeah,
because
that's all
just
it
like
was.
I look at what it was and what it is now, I'm like, by the naked eye, I can't see it. I'd have to break out the ruler and see it. So.
And, you know, there is a safety issue, and guys shoot a lot harder now than they did in the 80s. They move faster now than they did in the 80s, and you've got to make sure the goalies are protected. But I think there's a happy medium between these knights with suits of armor that come out and go between the pipes and fill up the entire net right now, and these beautiful shots that you're talking about on getting through, and, you know, a 1970s goalie with no equipment on whatsoever that would get injured in 2 seconds, you know, taking a 100-mile-an-hour slap shot. Now, I would much rather them go that route now first before they go to change the nets, which when you change the nets and if you heighten them up or do whatever you're going to have to do, you're not only doing it at the NHL, you're doing it in college hockey, you're doing it in junior hockey, you're doing it at all these levels, and you're really fundamentally changing the game.
You are, but you're not changing the rink. It's just all you've changed one thing. So maybe the style changes a little bit, but it's not a costly thing to do. If you start changing the parameters of the rink, or you know, when we see how the game opens up when they play on an Olympic size sheet of ice, it's just a simple thing. It'll take some adjustment. Some people will complain, some people will love it. I think it's the way to go.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I think there's a lot of different routes they go, but we obviously agree that offense has to be generated, and they've got to do something because
look at the NFL.
Yeah.
Well, the NFL is all about offense.
Well, because it's all about fantasy football and fantasy stats, and it's the same with hockey. I mean, that's a lot of what's going on here, and I think no doubt they're going to make changes because it's based on generating more fan interest with more offense and everything else and getting higher scores. One guy that doesn't want higher scores – Patrice Bergeron, I caught up with him for three periods, and you're going to like some of these answers, Walshy.
Three periods with Joe Haggerty here with Patrice Bergeron. Bergie, these are kind of different questions. Favorite sports movie of all time?
Sports movie. Remember the Titans? Yeah, I'll go with that.
Why that one?
It's just the story behind it and everything about the, you know, it's just... you know, being resilient and all that stuff. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, you like the inspirational ones more than like the kind of slapshot type?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, hockey movie slapshot is definitely up there. As a kid, I liked also Mighty Ducks. You know, the first one was, you know, I was really young, so
yeah. That
was pretty special. I mean, I loved hockey at that time, so, I still love it, but I'm just saying, like, it was pretty cool to have a movie like that.
What song, if you could only listen to one song to get you
sort of pumped up for a game or ready to play, what would it be?
Probably Lose Yourself by Eminem.
Yeah. Has that been a favorite for a while?
Yeah, it's been a favorite. I mean, it came out my only year of junior hockey, and I used to listen to it my first few games as a rookie, so over there. So
it always reminds you?
Always kind of reminds me of where I come from and what it got to get here, you know. So it's, and the lyrics are pretty cool too.
What TV shows do you have, like series recordings on your DVR that you like to watch?
So I have Homeland, Vikings, Game of Thrones, and I was one more season of Walking Dead. I'm kind of catching up on that, and that's it.
Any favorites among them? Is there one that you like? You try to watch it when it's on. You like, love it.
No, I don't like to. I actually like to wait for the season. Well, not the season, or like half the season to be done, so yeah. That they're all in DVR and I can just go. I can't just watch one.
The old binge watch.
Yeah, a little bit. I gotta go with right now. I mean, Game of Thrones is I really like, but I think I'm.
Do you read the books too? Have you read the books?
I read the first one, but then I kind of.
Yeah, they're big.
Yeah, they're big. Same thing with. I read like the Hunger Games, and I was like, let's just wait for the movies.
Yeah.
But yeah, Game of Thrones. If I have to pick one.
That's a good one.
All right, Walshy, that was a fun first episode. Did you have a good time today?
I did have a good time. So next time you're two people before me canceling, you give me a call. I'd be happy to join you.
I'm going
to
give you a call in a couple of weeks, and we're going to see if we can fit us into your busy schedule to make this happen again in the next episode. I know you're a busy guy. You've got kids. You've got a lot of responsibilities going around, and this is out of the goodness of your heart that you're doing the show, Walsh. So we're going to have to try to make that happen.
Well, I appreciate that. I am kind of busy, but I'm never too busy to talk hockey.
I appreciate that, Walsh. Me neither. That is absolutely the one truth about the both of us. Thanks for listening, everybody, and keep it great, keep it American, and always, Walshy, keep it about hockey.
Okay.